I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Skateboarding is an everyday passion for many American teens. Though some adults regard street skaters as public nuisances, the nation's top skaters tour professionally, making good livings and achieving celebrity among a devoted following. A powerful documentary film opening in New York this week chronicles the rise of commercial skateboarding in the 1980s through the tragic story of its most marketable star. Mark Rogowski, known in the skating world as Gator, combined athletic talent and showmanship to become a giant of skateboarding, but fell apart emotionally when the industry changed. His psychological decline ended in homicidal rage when Rogowski sadistically raped and murdered a woman in his apartment. He's currently serving a prison term for the murder of Jessica Bergston. The documentary about Rogowski is called Stoked, The Rise and Fall of Gator. Early in the film, we hear this segment of a telephone prison call from Rogowski.
It's been hard over these 10 years to understand how I could become so weak or, you know, so affected that I ended up hurting Jessica Bergston. I was a coward, emotionally and mentally. I hate what I did, and I've hated myself, my life, and my past. Even any good I did before seems to pale in comparison, like wiped out by my crime.
My guests are Helen Stickler, who produced and directed Stoked, and Ken Park, a former professional skater and a friend of Mark Rogowski's, who's interviewed in the film. Park eventually left skateboarding for college and a business career and is now president of a New York-based technology firm. Helen Stickler is an Emmy-nominated writer, producer, and director of documentary films and commercials. Her best-known documentary short is Andre the Giant Has a Posse. I asked Stickler how Mark Rogowski became a star.
He was a star of a skate video called Skate Visions, which was produced by Vision Skateboards. Through his sponsorship with Vision, he did receive royalties on skateboard decks, which had his graphic on it, and later through a clothing line, which also had his graphic, which was a kind of a descending spiral. It was an op art design, which they used for a number of years, and it was a top graphic in the 80s. And the graphic and the image that was created for him at Vision really served to brand him. He, I think you could say, was one of the first skateboarders to really, really understand and utilize the concept of branding. And a lot of that was because of Brad Dorfman, who ran Vision Streetwear.
When you saw someone like Mark, who, and I've said this so many times, way before the fame and way before the sponsorship even, you would be at the skate park with 7-8 other people in this, you know, tremendously large skateboard park, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Mark would appear. He'd never make a grand entrance, but he'd start consistently or, you know, systematically going from one of the areas to the next in the skate park. And I'm talking about areas in the skate park that nobody rode because they were either just incredibly non-rideable as the skateboard terrain goes, or it just everyone focused on this one area near the front of the park that had the keyhole, what we called the keyhole, which is one of the pools. But, you know, here's a guy that would go out, and literally every time he showed up to the park, he would skate every inch of that skate park, and he would do it with such style and such flair and such confidence that whether you liked the person wasn't really that important, because you couldn't help but respect the guy. He was just so gifted for this sport.
One of the things that established the image of Mark Rogowski, Helen Stickler, you note in your documentary, was the events at Virginia Beach in 1986. Mm-hmm. What did Mark do there that had such impact?
The Mount Trashmore event was a skateboard contest that happened every year in Virginia Beach in 1986. Mark went out there and he got into a little bit of trouble with the law. The contest was really, really big. The local authorities had doubled up the number of police and security guards just as a way to have crowd control. And what I was told is that Mark went out to either his hotel or went out to get some fast food. He just took off in his car to run an errand during the body of the contest, and when he came back, he pulled into the wrong parking lot or the wrong parking spot, or he didn't want to stop and get checked. So the what he thought was a security guard had followed him over to the car and jumped up and was, you know, ran up to the car window to get him, and he thought he was a security guard, and he punched him, and it was an actual state trooper or local, you know, policeman. So they arrested him, took him down to jail right in the middle of the contest. And three of the top industry people at the time went down there and bailed him out. I think Brad Dorfman told me it was something like $400. And they took him back to the contest, and he skated that day. It was an event for those, you know, thousands and thousands of kids that were there, and they didn't really like the high police security presence that was there either. There was a lot of tension going on, and he just manifested it. And either by coincidence or design, the next month's magazines, he got more coverage between ads, editorial, and photo opportunities than he did at any other time in his career. I think in his mind, being on top of the world and then getting away with something like that, it just solidified you know, his kind of bad boy image for himself as well as everyone else.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our interview with documentary filmmaker Helen Stickler and performer professional skateboarder Kenneth Park. Stickler's new documentary film, Stoked, chronicles the career of star skateboarder Mark Gator Rogowski. He rode his board to wealth and fame in the 1980s, but is now serving a prison term for rape and murder. When we left off, we were talking about the bad boy image Rogowski was cultivating at the height of his celebrity. Here's a clip from the film which illustrates that.
Well, I think I need to be interviewed, not only because I'm one of the most elite and dynamic, talented, big-headed, and versatile skaters on the circuit, but also because I'm one of the most blatant and outspoken jerks in the industry. It's really easy to say what you want, what's on your mind, and get away with it when you work for a company like Vision. It's really easy. There's no problems. You can always have a bad write-up in the local gossip column of Thrasher or Transworld, and receive some kind of promotion or exposure from it. It's great. I love getting arrested. I think I'm one of the most illegal skaters in the circuit too.
Looking back on it, I mean, is this the beginning of the kind of undoing of Mark Rogowski? Is this the criminal that we later see, or is this just a guy who enjoys a rebel image?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't want to take that out of context, because that piece of video was an outtake and he was joking around. I mean, he was definitely kind of teasing with his interviewer at that moment. He was being asked some kind of like mundane skateboard video questions, you know, like, why do you think you should be interviewed, was the question. Not such a great question. You know? And so he came up with an answer that was a joke, but there's a lot of the grain of a part of his personality is in there.
There was a change in skateboarding in the late 80s, which really hurt Mark Rogowski's image and his commercial potential. What was that all about?
Well, towards the end of the 80s, the vertical backyard ramp scene and the skate park scene, which was also mostly a vertical skating scene, was starting to die out for a number of reasons. A lot of the skate parks closed, and a lot of the backyard ramps were falling apart, and they're kind of expensive to maintain. And there was also the issue of liability at that time. If you were definitely liable if a kid was on your ramp while you weren't there and got hurt, so parents weren't supporting them as much anymore. So also because skateboarding had become so popular worldwide, you had kids who were in urban areas or, you know, over in Europe or wherever, where they weren't going to necessarily have access to backyard ramps, who wanted to skate. So they started to skate on other terrain. They started to skate on the streets, and they started to use park benches and handrails and, all kinds of ledges and things that you could find in urban centers as obstacles to skate on. And Mark, definitely came from a suburban background. He was still very focused on vert skating. And he was also, at that time when this started happening in the late 80s, he was really focused on his career at that time. And so this transition was happening. And Mark was getting a little older. He was getting more into the business end of things. And the younger kids coming up were doing a different style of skating. A change happened that he wasn't exactly a part of.
So this street skating phenomena arose, and he didn't have the moves and the skills for it, right? I mean, some of the most compelling video you have is him attempting to learn some street skating moves and flinging his skateboard to the pavement in frustration. It's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, that particular clip is another outtake from a skateboard video that was shot in the very late 80s. And a couple things are going on. Like, Mark is trying to do vert moves on the curb, and I think he was trying to innovate, but what I see in that shot is that he's under pressure because camera's pointed at him, and they're like, okay, Mark, be a star, do some street skating. We need street skating because that's what we're promoting now, and it wasn't his thing. So when he's reacting in anger, it's a combination of things going on in his head. Like, he doesn't really have the moves because it isn't his thing. He's under all kinds of pressure. You know, he's failing to himself and in front of the camera, which means the eyes of all of his public. So you can really see his frustration coming out, like all this anger, and he yells, "I suck." He's just upset with himself. Later on, he did master the handrail, and he did get to do some more street skating, but it was a little too late for him at that point. And I also kind of feel like, maybe he wasn't as hungry for it anymore. Like, he'd had his moment in the sun. He was ready to move on to other things. But he still wasn't quite ready to let it go. And I think there's a lot of conflict there, for him. Because he could have gotten good at it if he wanted to practice it as hard as you need to practice to get good. I don't know if he had that drive in him anymore.
If I can add one aspect of street skating, you have to understand, when you watch someone skate a pool or you watch someone skate a vert ramp, It's the series of tricks that makes that so exciting and so enthralling to be a part of. You're literally doing 8 to 16 tricks, one after another, gaining more and more speed every single step along that ride. So because the kids that had now grown so attached to the sport might not have been able to even perform on a vertical ramp on one of the backyard ramps, what they end up doing is going down to the schoolyard, and street skating evolved as more of a one-trick type of progression. You would try one thing over and over and over again. So for someone that had grown up in pools and someone that had grown up on the backyard ramps, where it was the continuity of your run that gave you the thrill, trying one trick and missing it 30 times in a row so that you could make it on the 31st attempt was the furthest thing from enjoyable. And so here's this massively popular uprising in skateboarding taking place. And I think that the typical skater that had been in the pro circuit and had been skating the vertical ramps and that had been skating the pools just really had a hard time embracing an activity that was so dramatically different from what they had grown up doing.
Kent Park, what did you observe of Mark during this period when his fortunes were falling?
Well, I think that the first thing I noticed is that before his financial fortunes had fallen, the notoriety and attention and respect had fallen first. And I think he had a much harder time, to a certain extent, with that aspect of what he was losing than even making the adaptation to the loss of finances, because he had been, in a situation in his life where he didn't have much money. And yes, now he had gone from having a lot to maybe not having as much. But the loss of attention, the loss of respect, the loss of notoriety, it changed his personality dramatically. In fact, one specific occurrence, I approached him at a party at his house in Fallbrook, which is shown in the movie. And I pulled him aside and I looked him in the eye as a friend to a friend, not as a skater to a skater. And I said, "Mark, I think you're losing sight of who it is that you are. And I think you're losing sight of how, in the scope of things, the skateboarding part of our lives is just one small aspect. And it's going to be fleeting and it's going to be transitional. And you're pushing people away from you. And if it doesn't stop, you're going to lose us." And he looked me right back in the eye and said, "Then I'll lose you." And literally, that was the finality of our really close relationship, all summed up with one statement. And I remember being pained by that moment, because we had grown like two brothers, very fond and very supportive of each other, even though we were very different people.
This is the period in which he ends up committing the crime that got him in prison. How did he end up coming into contact with Jessica Bergston?
Yeah. the victim of his crime had been his girlfriend's best friend when they were younger, and Mark had only met Jessica a few times in his life, and she was not even living in California. What happened is Mark and Brandy split up, and because they'd had such an off-and-on relationship throughout their whole time together, in the past, when he pushed her away, she would always be brokenhearted and crying, and he was always able to get her back pretty easily. And what happened this final time, because he had just become, I think she'd come to the end of her attraction with him. I mean, I think that they were still attracted, but what happened the final time that he pushed her away is that she found someone else. And this just didn't bode well. Mark started to follow her. He broke into her mother's house where she was living, and he took back everything he'd ever given her. She told me that later he took back a car that he'd bought her, just like a used Volkswagen car that he'd gotten her. Later she told me that the cops found the car with all of her stuff in it burnt to a shell in the desert. She was really frightened, and he would call and leave threatening messages on her answering machine, quoting from the Bible and using the Bible as a way to justify his anger towards her and prove that she was a sinner and that, you know, she needed to change her ways and on and on and on. And so, you know, she was ready to get out of the relationship. And coincidentally, at the time, she had gotten an opportunity to move to New York, which is something she'd always wanted to do. Mark was really pressuring her to become a born-again Christian and settle down and lead a quiet life. He was ready to put, you know, skating behind him, I think, because, as Ken mentioned earlier, skating had already made that decision for him. Brandy was 20 years old, and she just wanted to explore life and have adventures. She was definitely not on the same track. So Brandy moved to New York, and then her friend moved to San Diego right around the same time, and her friend gave Gator a call. And it was just the wrong place at the wrong time.
What happened?
Well, Mark had a lot of unresolved anger in his life, and it goes way deep. You know, it wasn't just skating. It wasn't just his girlfriend leaving him. It was, you know, his family situation. I think there was just abandonment issues that he had that were unresolved. He had a drinking problem that just made the whole thing worse. And he was an undiagnosed bipolar manic depressive. So he had been going into a deep spiral of depression and not dealing with it at all. And this young lady came along, and he just took out all of his rage and anger upon her. I don't think it was... You know, I think it was just a shock to everybody, including himself.
So he meets her for lunch, that's right, and is that right? And then brings her back to his apartment?
Yeah, she had called him, and he'd called her back, and they'd gone back and forth talking on the phone for a while. She'd literally only been in town for a number of days, and they made a date to meet for lunch. He had some meetings in the morning with his manager. Actually, he called her from Bill Silva's office to you know, confirm the date. Went and picked her up in Pacific Beach, where she lived, which is a kind of a really youth-centered, kind of hip, you know, sort of place in San Diego. Picked her up, took her to La Jolla. They had lunch. And then it just became an extended day. They decided to go back to his place. They picked up some wine along the way, some videos. He had not been drinking for a while because he'd been trying to clean up his act and lead a Christian life. And I think during the course of that day, you know, there was a lot of back and forth about his decisions to you know, become a Christian and to walk the path with Jesus. And that became a source of you know, conversation and debate between the two of them. The day stretched on very long. Sometime that night, you know, he beat her and raped her, and in the morning put her into a surfboard bag and zipped it up, and she died.
So her body was found, right?
Yeah, her body, her remains were found by some campers out in the desert. They were found several weeks after she was left there, and it was identified as her body was identified as a Jane Doe. At the time that this was going on, there were something like 30 women in the Southern California area that were missing that fit her description, so there weren't a lot of leads to go on. Mark was questioned because the phone records showed that they had had conversations, and he denied having ever seen her. And some months later, he confessed. He went to his religious mentor, and he told him what he had done. They discussed it. They, in the early morning hours, went down to San Diego to the police station and said, you know, he said, I've committed murder, and I want to confess. And they said, you know, where did it happen? Where do you live? He said, Oceanside. They say, you need to go up to the Vista County Police. So he had to go to another police station, and, you know, I mean, they just said, go up there, and you're at the wrong station. So he went uptown, and he confessed there, and they were like, okay. They didn't even have anything on, I mean, they had the missing person on file, but they didn't have this listed as a possible homicide, so they just basically advised him of his rights, which he waived, and he gave a full confession, you know, a very lucid full confession, and then he led them to where he had left the body, and they called the local authorities there, who confirmed that they had found a Jane Doe in that area some weeks earlier.
You know, the last 10 minutes of your film is not easy to watch as you go through the details of this crime. And as a storyteller, I mean, I wonder if you felt that you had to keep that from the audience for most of the film in order to make it. I wonder if you had to keep that from the audience to prevent the film from just being too dark. I mean, it is such a savage crime.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, we spent a lot of time. That was the toughest thing. And documentaries are put together in the editing room. You know the story going in, but you don't have a script. You don't have a blueprint when you start to put it together. So we did experiment with a lot of different structures for the narrative. And I even had some kind of work-in-progress shows for, you know, colleges and for lots of groups of people trying to figure out what was the best way to present the story. There was so much going on in the story. It covers 10 years. It's only 80 minutes long. It's got working on all these different levels. It's about an individual story. It's about skateboarding culture. It's about pop culture. And it has to combine this really, all the innocence, all the commercialism of the years, and then this horrible crime, and balance all that out, and then also somehow have some semblance of a resolution at the end. So we do tip people off at the beginning that a crime has been committed, but it's not until later and that you find out all the details. And I felt like I didn't want to hold back on what he had done, just as I didn't hold back on how great he was in the beginning. You know, I let everything be in there, all extremes, because that was the truth of the matter.